grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 304 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, coming to you live tonight from Austin, Texas. Had a great episode last week, you know, talking about all kinds of fun stuff. We have really had a great run here, just ending 300 episodes, coming into 304 right now. You can see our brand new branding package, all kinds of stuff, new graphics up on screen, nice pretty look for year five, folks. So thank you so much for everyone who is tuned in regularly for all that. Thank you so much for the people that have actively been calling in and leaving love on our listener line. Please do not forget to go by and visit that sometime, folks. If you get a chance, you can stop on by Dudes and Beer and get the phone number. Heck, I'll give you the phone number right now. It is 512, hold on, it just disappeared off my screen. There it is, 512-677-4155. And you can either leave comments for our guests, comments about the show, show ideas, guest ideas, questions for our guests. We will be having Dennis Stone, the owner of America's Stonehenge, on tonight to talk about that amazing, mystical, and mysterious monument out there in New Hampshire. Let's check out this clip real quick from one of our listeners who called the line.
Well, like the man once said, when you hear something that cool, you just got to clap. So,
thank you, my friend.
Appreciate y'all, man. This is Frazier. I just figured I'd drop by and say hi.
Frazier, thank you so much for listening.
Hey,
oh yeah, his dog Thor.
Yeah, my puppy said he's not too vocal at this time.
So, thank you so much for continuing to tune in, Frazier. It is listeners like you that we greatly appreciate out there. My favorite thing about that message was, quite honestly, the music in the background. It was like he was listening to Franz Liszt or something like that. He had this amazing classical piano music going on. Before we bring our guest on real quick, let's do take one quick moment to recognize our sponsors, the good people at HC Universal Network. We have some great shows over there. All the family over there, thank you so much for the many years that we have had together. I look forward to us all conquering 2021 together. With that in mind, let's go ahead and check out this little commercial real quick from Podcast Cadet. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com.
Right. Oh, sorry about that. Stop on by podcastcadet.com today to get your discount. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use. You can save 20% off your entire cart while you're there. Make sure to stop on by the all-new Dudes and Beer website. As I said, new graphics package means new website. Newly designed, fresh, crisp for all your wild entertainment. All the episodes there, all of our links, all of our friends, videos from all of our guests, everything else. Speaking of guests, our guest tonight, the amazing Dennis Stone. I have heard him on shows for good Lord knows how long. At least since I've been into Coast to Coast, and that was back in the Art Bell days, and I had a good over decade of that. So to have him on this evening to talk about his little piece of property out there in New Hampshire, known as America's Stonehenge, this mysterious monument that his family took on years ago and that he has carried on. They have a new free app out there that we will be talking about tonight. Welcome to the show, Dennis Stone. How are you today?
Well, hi, Chris. How are you doing? I can just barely hear you cutting in and out.
Oh, no,
thank
sorry.
Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
So sorry about that. Are things better on your end now?
I can hear you now. Yeah, okay. I was getting about every other word. I kind of figured out you were introducing me. So.
Sorry.
But I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on this evening, and you sound loud and clear now.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, sometimes it takes... That's one reason why I like to connect a good 20, 30 minutes beforehand, especially once you mute microphones. Systems like Skype and Zoom and stuff can have that latency to pick up the microphones and all that. So being able to connect early is really helpful. As was our conversation beforehand, you have lived quite the amazing life. You are one of those people that would lead what some folks have called the charmed life. When it comes to, you know, seeing the world from an airliner cockpit.
Thank you.
You have a.
I kind of miss it.
Well, and I imagine so. I don't know a single person that made their living as a pilot that when they stopped flying, when they retired from the business, that they didn't just miss it every day. You know.
And
it really is that that being in the air. You know, that moving things from place to place. There's nothing like it. And I get some of that giddy thrill whenever I get to set up a show and tear it down and know that that show will never, ever exist that way again. Like, doesn't matter if you've taken the route from Indianapolis to Austin 28 times a week. Each one is different, you know?
Definitely. That feeling you get, definitely, yeah. I did it for 35 years. I flew for about 42 years, and then I kind of stopped cold turkey, you know, when I retired. So it was quite a change of life. Fortunately, for me, I had the America Stonehenge, you know, and it's been in my family since I was basically a baby, you know. So I worked there on my days off from the airline. So I could kind of transition from that into the museum. But I do miss the flying of the aircraft, definitely, and some of the crew members and stuff like that. And, you know, and going places, too, you know. Being on the road every day, you know, 4 days or 5 days out of the week sometimes to being here all the time and not traveling. Actually, the last time we really traveled was about a year ago. So it's quite a change, you know, quite a change of pace. And I kind of miss some of that.
Yeah. Cause it really is an up and go type situation. When you're a pilot, you are on the go constantly for an airline.
Yeah, definitely.
But in the same right, since you have been back and able to fully take over the reins of America's Stonehenge, it seems like there has been a lot of progress out there at that property, and you guys have been doing a lot of renovations out there. You guys, like you were saying pre-show, have, and I guess it's because A, you're already an attraction to begin with, B, you're outdoor attraction. So the opportunity for it was never really a situation of, hey, you know, we have 3,000 people at a time traipsing through America's Stonehenge. Y'all already controlled the number of people that went there because it is an archaeological site, that kind of stuff. So there was already a certain modicum of social distancing, that kind of thing, which kind of led y'all to actual success during all of this.
Yeah, fortunately for us, we have quite a bit of property. So, and we have people up there. They're socially spaced, you know, just naturally, you know, as they exactly. walk around the grounds, you know. So that's really good. It's fresh air. It's on the hill. It's very pretty. We're about 40 miles north of Boston, about 20 miles from the coast. You're right in southern New Hampshire, and the hill's very pretty, you know. And we are doing a forestry project up there for the last year. But when I retired, I thought, well, maybe I'll be a little bit bored, you know. But what happened in 2016 when I retired, we started finding some features that my dad and other researchers that spent decades there never basically saw or found, you know. So it's been really exciting for us just in the last couple of years. As a matter of fact, they're so new, some of these finds, we haven't put them on a four-page tour guide map yet.
Oh,
we have
wow.
to update that. Yeah, but we have put it on our diorama when you come into the museum. Of course, I mentioned the visitor center is closed at the moment, and sure. we're doing renovations inside. We're taking advantage of that. So everything is outdoors now. You can buy your ticket online. You can watch our 12-minute, you know, film that we show in our theater right in your smartphone, you know, or watch it at home. And then we have that free app download I mentioned to you, which is people love that, you know, everybody that uses it. And you can actually do a complete tour at your home in your Lazy Boy chair. You know, you don't even have to come and visit us. You may want to after seeing it, but you know, you can do the whole thing and it doesn't cost anything. But yeah, we've a lot of new discoveries just in the last 4 years. And, actually some of these features that we're finding are being found not only at our site, but across the Northeast and actually all the way out to, Mount Shasta, California, similar stone features. And some
wow.
of this we're still discovering today, you know, very recently, you know, like, did you know that some of these things exist in Oregon or up in Washington State? I'm like, no, I did not. And, but I do have 110 pictures from the Mount Shasta area, a town called Weed, California, and they got the same kind of stonework that we have that surrounds our main site. But in New England, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and actually Quebec, Canada, there's about 800 different sites. And when my dad got involved with this back in 1955, they knew of about maybe, we'll say about 15 sites in the Northeast. So from 15 sites, you know, besides ours, up to over 800 over the last 65 years. And we keep discovering more, but not just in the Northeast, but going across the nation, you know. So there may be something more, you know, wide ranging to this whole thing than just the Northeast. There's, my dad died 11 years ago, you know, and he did not know some of these features existed out west, Colorado, Alabama, Indiana, California.
Sure.
You know, and I mentioned the other couple of states. Yeah, he wasn't aware of, he wasn't only aware they weren't out there. He didn't know our site had some of these features. And one of the features we found since 2016 are serpentine walls. These are walls that look like a snake.
Oh, wow.
And they can range from, yeah, they can range from like 30 feet up to the longest one we believe we have. I mean, who knows? If we could talk to the people that built this site, we would know for sure. But when you look at the walls and they have a head, they have an undulating body, and then they have like a pointed tail. And the longest one we have is about 2,550 feet long. We used a GPS to actually map it and measure it. And it comes around, this whole tail comes back around by itself in front of its head, if you will. It's a big glacial boulder that looks like a serpent head. It looks like it's biting its tail like the Ouroboros.
Huh.
And it's like, oh, my God. You know, the Egyptians and Greeks and other civilizations,
yeah.
even over here, the Ouroboros can represent the eternity of the circle of life. We think we have approximately 13 serpent walls that are on our hilltop over the 110 acres. And some are linear, you know, straight. Some are rectilinear with the head 90 degrees or the tail 90 degrees. And some are curved, just beautiful sweeping curves like S's and stuff like that.
Yeah, and we've got one up in our slide gallery going right now that is just a beautiful, almost sine wave.
Oh, you can see that.
Curve.
Oh, you got it up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I went and robbed all of your content from your website, my friend.
We appreciate it. We appreciate it. It's only worth some glad
there's,
you got
there's
those,
nothing
really,
like showing people. It's one thing to describe
yeah.
it, but it's another thing
yeah.
entirely to actively see mm. these structures.
Yeah,
and
definitely. Yeah.
You know, to see some of this stuff. And even, like, I'm a big fan of Curse of Oak Island.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. they've even yeah. found a serpentine-type mound up there on Oak Island recently.
That's interesting because 2 weeks ago, one of my high school friends, actually elementary, junior high, and we stayed friends over the years. He sent me something about that show, and he said, "Dennis, do you know this is before Christmas?" So I met the kid back. He goes, "Do you watch Oak Island?" I say, "Occasionally, I do." He goes, "They were talking about Serpent Wall or something." I'm like,
"Yeah,
huh."
Yeah.
Oh, so you're the second person to tell me this. I'll have to check it out.
Check it out. It was literally all of 2 weeks ago. All of 2 weeks ago.
That's right.
That's revealed. I love it because that's one of my wife's guilty pleasures now. It was one of those shows that, like, I don't have cable. Yeah. We cut the lines a long time ago on that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
We have, like, HBO, Netflix, things like that. I watched shows like that whenever I was on the road. So that was my guilty pleasure while I sat there and coded website in my off hours or prepped for shows. I would have things like Oak Island and that kind of stuff on in the background, you know? It's nice now that my wife is like, "Oh, is the new episode out?" And I'm like, "Oh, all right." But yeah, that was really interesting. And
thank you for that.
So many serpentine motifs that go on in structures across the Americas, period.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And one of the interesting structures that y'all have there that has fascinated people for years is called the sacrificial table.
Mm-hmm.
At least called the sacrificial table, because I mean, we of course quantify what the use might be, but we don't know that for sure. Let's start going into a little bit of the paleoarchaeology of this site and the actual what we do know about things that are there.
Well, the site, it's a hilltop of about 110 acres. The main site where most of the stone structures, chambers, if you will, are located, cover about 1 acre. And outside of that, we have 15 acres that contain the astronomical alignments. There are 51 alignments of the sun, the moon, and stars. And actually, the wall that surrounds that 15 acres is the longest serpentine wall, we believe. It actually touches every astronomical alignment. Sunrise, sunset, moonrise, and moonset, and star alignment. And then it goes counterclockwise, that wall. It does a couple of undulations with its back. Some of those undulations are actually like cross-quarter days, like November 1st, February 1st, cross-quarter days. And it touches, like I say, all the other astronomical alignments, and it comes back and humps right in front of its head, does a 90-degree twist, and it looks like it's biting its tail. But the main site, we think, was probably a ceremonial site, just like the 15 acres surrounding it. And we don't think it was a living place. The amount of tools that came out of it, we have hammer stones, we have rubbing stones, stone scrapers, stone hoes, arrowheads, stone knives, all sorts of stone implements that came out of the last 83 years worth of digging. So there is a Stone Age technology going on there with the stone tools. But if it was a place where people lived, the structures probably would have had more space in them for one thing. A lot of work went into these structures, and they yield very little interior space. But also, I think you'd find the middens, you know, the places where they threw their refuge, their trash. And although we do find artifacts, not the quantity of where people would live. Almost, I think the site looks a lot like the megalithic sites of Western Europe, which we've visited many times. It doesn't mean the same people built it, but they were mostly tombs, temples, and monuments from our best guess today. And it may not be totally correct, you know.
Sure.
But archaeologists pull their hair out of their head, because when they're digging on sites like Stonehenge, they do find a few tools. They find, you know, some remains of human beings in some of the 56 Aubrey holes. But they don't find a lot of household goods, and that tells a whole story about the people generally.
You don't find a lot of pottery. You don't find a lot of evidence of people like shacking up there for extended periods. They may get together there for a month or so for a solstice gathering or something like that, but then they move on.
Yep.
And one of the questions that popped up in my head, just the pictures that I've seen over the years, and of course the archaeoastronomy that goes on at the site, is the confined space perhaps, are those spaces like the small caverns that are made, things like that, are those lined up with observational points to where perhaps they're just supposed to be something to block out the rest of the light so that you can perhaps see planets at sunrise, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're onto something there because, well, some of the structures do look like some of the, I've been in Ireland and we've been all over Europe, sure. Well, not every country, but we've been a lot of places in Malta and everything. And what I've seen, like our, what we call the V-Hut, our V-Hut is shaped like the letter V and it has a big stone roof on top of it. And it faces the southwest, kind of in the direction of the winter solstice, generally speaking, yep. Sunset, kind of. But when my dad and I went to Ireland in 83 and spent a week there riding around looking at, they have like 2,000 megalithic sites. We looked at quite a few of them, Newgrange and all of that, you know, and Nelth and Delph. But when we went into different parts of Ireland, into the west coast too, we saw some wedge tombs, and a couple of them looked just like our V-Hut, the size, the shape, and orientation. And they believed they were used for burial tombs over there, and it's possible that our structure was used for that same purpose. Just next to that is a structure we call the East-West Chamber. It runs roughly 30 feet true east and west out of true north, not magnetic. And it looks like the Gallagher graves. I've seen them in France near Karnak. They're also in Ireland, and they're in the Netherlands, and they call them the Giant's Bed in the Netherlands. And one of my friends, he's an author, and he's been on TV shows like History, what is it, Mysteries at the Museum and stuff like that. But anyway, he was over there last year, so it's a year and a half ago. And when he was there, he was texting me, and I said, hey, what's the direction out of true north at that Giant's Bed? He was looking at a couple of them. I said, but he was looking at one particular one. He goes, oh, it's true east and west. And you look at the size, the shape, and the orientation, it does look like our east-west chamber. We have great big orthostats, big stones as slabs are quarried and then stood vertically up for the wall and the big capstones on top. But the watch house actually is kind of outside of that 1 acre, and it's the head of that 2,550-foot serpent. There's a rock in the back wall of it. And it's a quartzite stone. It's very white, where the rest of the stones are kind of grayish colors or darker. We've been looking at that for decades, and there's been speculation in different books by like Hans Holzer in 1992, and other books written before and after that. Was what is that? Could that be something that could be lit up by the sun? We just don't know. My friend from Texas, she's in Bullitt. She was up twice to see this site. She just loves the site. And when she was up a year and a half ago with her phone, she pulled out, she had an app on it called Sunseeker, and she was inside the chamber. And I didn't have that app on my phone. I could have done it too, but she's pretty good with it. You know, she's really talented. She went to college for that, you know, took astrophysics and all, you know, archaeoastronomy and all. Anyway, she's in there and she's looking, and she goes, I think at about 9 o'clock on your equinox, you're going to see the sunlight illuminate the stone. So we had to wait about a year to see that. And last spring, she was here a year ago last spring. So last spring on the equinox, we were about five or six of us there, and we photographed it. We did a time lapse. And about, actually it was a little bit earlier in the morning, roughly 8 o'clock in the morning to about 8:30, about 30 minutes, the sun rose and not only illuminated the stone in the back wall, but it actually framed it because of the shape of the entrance of the structure. It actually had a shadow and light frame, and it was the shape of the rock in the back wall.
Yeah.
And if you know, like the sun could be the male, and the sunlight's fertilizing the sperm going in, like Newgrange, and lighting up the back wall, fertilizing the egg. And the Newport Tower in Rhode Island does the same thing. Those are winter solstices. This is spring and fall equinox. And that's a timeline. We have that on YouTube, and it's the most beautiful illumination effect. You know, it's about 30 minutes long. What you'll see is about 30 seconds, the time lapse, you know. And so it didn't take you long to watch it, but it's on YouTube, and it's like, whoa. So this head of the serpent and the Ouroboros, and it's an illumination, and the head, the boulder, actually is a February 1st cross quarter day and a lunar minor standstill moonrise, which will be coming up in, I think it's 2034, we'll be watching that. Now, so it's like a multifunctional chamber. It does a lot of different things, you know.
Now this is not discounting the Native American tribes of America. Mm. All right.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
But they are not exactly and precisely known as calendar builders, my friend.
And the thing, too, is in the Northeast, the tradition is they weren't building big stone structures.
Yeah.
They were making stone into tools. I mean, we might be wrong on that. The Native Americans were here for over 10,000 years. But,
now, granted,
you know, were they the builders?
Yeah, and granted, there are cases of, like, fire pits being dug up that are dated beyond 10,000 years in Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
Show pottery, things like what you're talking about that would normally show a settlement, not a nomadic people, not people just randomly wandering. We camped here for the night. We hunted. We broke a piece of pottery. But to the point of these were places where they came and lit repeated fires. These were places where they had like wigwams set up, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And is there anything showing like that there? Because like I'm saying, for all of this archaeoastronomy, the Native American cultures were not necessarily known as ones that did a whole lot in the realm of archaeoastronomy. So where do some of the, and I may be wrong in that, but from what I know, like, of course, they all claim ancestry from the stars, things like that. But I don't know of too many working walking calendars like Stonehenge is, like America's Stonehenge is, like Pumapunku, you know, megalithic size sites like this, which isn't necessarily megalithic. I mean, granted, the big stones there that you see, probably a good 20, 25 men could lift, you know. And they're probably about 7-8 feet off the ground, so it's nothing crazy. But the archaeoastronomy is what strikes me as interesting about this place, and what has always fascinated me. Because where did this come from?
Right. Yeah, we began the work on the archaeoastronomy back in 1965 when Gerald Hopkins from the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, originally from England, he was British, he came over and he wrote a paper in 63, and then he had the book come out in 65, Stonehenge Decoded. Then he wrote wrote another book after that later. But the CBS special came out, The Mysteries of Stonehenge, that same year in 65. And my dad and other researchers going back into the 30s knew that these monoliths are out in the woods. You know, they look like big arrowheads, you know. About half are still standing, maybe half are fallen. And some of these are up to 10 feet tall. One of the biggest ones is actually a star alignment with eyes are. And that one's over 14 feet. It's like a menhir, which means a long stone, you know. But they were wondering, what are these big stones standing out in the woods? What are they for? There's a purpose to them. If you're going to stand something up like that, you have to take it off the bedrock. You got to shape it. And then you got to transport it, perhaps a short distance, maybe not a long distance, but, and then you stand it upright. Is there a significance to these, and they were contemplating that for decades, So when that show came out in 65 and they got the book Stonehenge Decoded, it's like, oh, maybe these are tied in with astronomy somehow, and so in 67, they had actually cleared out the First Avenue, and it was the winter solstice sunset alignment. And it was about 800 feet of tree clearing, just so you could see the horizon and the stone from the central site. And it wasn't until 1970, we just had the 50th anniversary, that my dad, a neighbor of mine, his name was Kip. He was from the town of Derry where we were living, about 8 miles from the site. And our manager, and he lived property abutting our the site. So we came down to his house. It was actually his parents' house. And he was about 19 or 20. He became a nuclear physicist for his life. And he was at Fukushima when that went off, and he's back in Maine now after all those years in France and around the world working for the nuclear industry. Very, very smart guy. But he was really into the astronomy back then in the 60s. So he helped to clear the avenues. He had plotted this on some of the maps we had. But anyway, by 1970, we were standing there on the winter solstice, and we were watching, and there was a few clouds, and it was very cold. There was about a foot of snow. And actually, he built a snowmobile out of wood. He took parts from old parts from some snowmobiles, put them together on a wooden frame, and he made a wooden snowmobile, and he had an IV bottle for the gasoline hanging up high. It looked like it was amazing. What a contraption. I asked him recently, because he has moved back to the United States and is living up in Maine, and he's visited us once since he came back from Japan. I said, that machine's still around, by the way? He goes, no, it ended up being recycled into other things I built. I'm like, oh, my God. He was very talented. So the machine broke the trail. It was about a foot of snow, a half a mile. We walked through the snow, got up there, and then we're standing there in the afternoon. I believe it was December 20th, it was 1970. And we're watching, and the sun's slowly setting, and there's a few clouds. We're getting worried maybe a cloud will block the sunset. But it worked out so beautifully. My dad took pictures of the whole thing, a whole sequence of them. And it became postcards, and we used to sell the slides, and actually have a painting. My dad used to paint too, you know, as a painter and like an artist. And he made a lot of different structures around New England. You know, we have them in the museum if you come and visit us. But one of them is of that event. The first time that people probably watched a sunset or any astronomical alignment, perhaps in thousands of years. So we were kind of like, wow, maybe we're pretty special, you know, here we are. And it actually set right over the top of the stone. Looks like, again, a big arrowhead.
Oh, and, it's gorgeous. So, I've got a picture of it up on screen right now. Like I said, I stole all the stuff from y'all's website. I mean, like, dude, it's going to be a background on my side screen for I don't know how long. It is just entrancingly beautiful.
It's very pretty, yeah.
The image.
Very, very pretty.
And
it looks so intentional, too, you know, so intentional. Like, I mean, some skeptics have said, well, you have coincidences, but, you know, there are 51 alignments. There are 24 with stars.
Yeah.
That was from the Hobbit Smithsonian Report in 1978.
One or two accidental alignments is one thing. Once you hit five and beyond, you've got something.
As
a trained observer, which, I mean, pilots are beyond. They are trained in dead reckoning and what that means, folks, is imagine being 15,000 feet in the air going about 300 miles an hour and suddenly all your instruments go dead, but you still got to know what direction you're headed in and where approximately where you are in three dimensional space. That's what these guys were trained to do. To know pilots, to have pilots be able to come on and testify to things like this is fantastic. I always love it. I've been looking for an airline pilot to come on for years. So to have you in my back pocket now is fantastic.
When I was flying, I told my co-pilots about this, you know, we've been sitting there for hours flying along and they into, you know, astronomy, you know, a little bit of geology, archaeology and this mystery. And they really enjoyed that. Well, one of the original researchers on this, besides my dad, was his first cousin named Oz, last name of Stone, just like, you know, the same thing. But Oz was a World War II pilot. He flew B-17s, 29s, and the Super 20s. And he got shot down in Belgium during the war and everything. And it ended up in Stars and Stripes. And it still pops up on the website. He just died 5 years ago at 95 years old. And he was a friend of Alan Shepard at Pinkerton Academy, where I went to school too. Alan was a student there, and my uncle and him were friends. My uncle went into the Army Air Corps, and Alan went into the Navy. But my uncle was one of the guys that he moved back from Point Mugu, California. He used to work on rocket sled tests too in VOR navigation right after the war. And by 1960, he moved back to New Hampshire. Put my dog's back. And he, 1960, he moved back to New Hampshire, and he got involved with our museum. And he was one of the original guys that got involved with the astronomy. So, all those years. So,
and that's why I say dead reckoning is important when you're talking about this, because as a pilot, is it something that going out and seeing this alignment with the sun might just be something that is coincidental, you know?
But
a pilot understands that, like, when somebody puts a marker to mark a cardinal direction, that it's there for a reason.
And that's what we have too. We have the four cardinal directions at our site: true north and south, east and west. You know, and then we have all the solar, lunar, and the stellar alignments too.
Well, yeah, because so, I mean, I've got it paused right now on y'all's video, which is a very poignant overhead graphic of the area that has the site marked, and it literally almost looks like a starburst of radiations coming out that are not drawn or highlighted. They are the natural features of what was quite obviously carved out of the woods.
Yeah,
where trees were cleared.
Well, actually, most of that is us. The ancient people would have to do a little bit of that. They would have to do some of that, too. That was, like I say, started in 65. But what we have been doing with our with her archaeologist. She just retired, actually. She was a president of the New Hampshire Archaeological Society, and she joined us in 89, and she just gave her notice this fall, and we met with her, and she's in Florida right now, but she's retiring because of her age, but she's been wonderful. And she's done a shovel test pit study across the hilltop, and her husband was a doctor of geology at Tufts University for 30 years, so he knew the geology very good, you know. And one of the questions was, how much dirt was on top of this hill 4,000 years ago? And although we don't have anything really precise to tell us exactly how much dirt, it's been accumulating very slowly, and it's from windblown soil and particles and vegetation decay, and it's about 125 years for an inch. But we have erosion up there, too. But she did a shovel test pit study. It's called an STP. It's a 50-centimeter diameter a hole in the ground, basically. And she did about between 1990, she joined us in 89, worked on the North Stone, which is one of the stones that aligns with Polaris. 4,000 years ago, it was aligned with a stack called Thuban.
Oh, wow.
She found a fire pit. Yeah, and it was starting to tip in 1988. We decided in 89 to do an excavation and maybe to stabilize it. And that's when she joined us in 89. And she was mainstream archaeology, and our site is not mainstream, but she was willing to stick her neck out, come down and take a look, and she stuck with us for over three decades, which is wonderful. And she tried to get some of her colleagues, and she brought a few of them in reluctantly. You know, they're like, well, that's just a, you know, a bunch of rocks up there. They, you know, their archaeology is, you know, ancient and Native American, which is cool, but it's usually pots and points, you know, or colonial, you know, and they don't know about stone walls and standing stones and chambers, you know, that's not what they know or were trained in.
Well, so and like I said, because that is not the atypical Native American history, construction, anything like that.
Right.
Like maybe when you get to the Southwest, you'll see some adobe work, you know, maybe some flat stone work, things like that. But to see what you see at America's Stonehenge, to see this kind of work, to see, and even though, like what you're saying, this overhead is, and I didn't even think about that, obviously, paths that y'all have cleared. But even the ancient people who built this site would have had to have those sight lines. And when you look at it, it's like, it straight up looks like a runway. It looks like it looks like somebody's observational deck of a set of runways, you know, where it's like, yep, this is where they all cross east and west, you know. So it very obviously looks like a centralized point from which observations of the heavens took place east to west. If those lines of sight were cleared the way that they are right there.
You know, and what we think from the shovel test pit study is that she said basically the hilltop 4,000 years ago is probably, and she used her husband, you know, as an expert too, and he was well known in New England, Dr. James Hume, but she said basically that the hilltop is probably 75% bare ground and maybe 25% covered with earth, and that means there were some trees and brush, and because the ancients would have used some of that for firewood and for probably tools, log rollers and, you know, that kind of thing. They would have had done a little bit of clearing, but not to the extent that my family has done since 1965, you know, when they began the project with the astronomy. But they would have had to probably remove some trees, and they would have made use of the trees, obviously, too. You know, they would have needed that wood for different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Very, you know, they're very thrifty, I guess. They're very, you know, but, like a Yankee, you know, we're very, very practical, you know.
Hey, if you can use it, guy.
Use it, yeah, exactly. And they did.
Well, I'm sure they did. But once again, that's one of the curious things, is that this is no small undertaking. I mean, even once again, just looking at the still frame of this overhead, that is a massive swath. That's big. Look at the structures, you know, maybe one of these structures could have been built over the period of, you know, maybe a week by a few people. But once again, to lift those big stones that comprise the front entrance of some of these chambers would take a smooth, good 20 really able people. Like some people that were like, hey, how you doing? My name is, you know, Sven. I'm in the World Lifting Championship, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Those
and most of this, because, of course, New Hampshire is the Granite State.
Right.
Most of this is granite stone, correct?
It is, yeah. And granite weighs about 163 pounds per cubic foot, so we can estimate the weight. One of the biggest roof slabs, the roof slabs are generally some of the bigger stones, you know, the table, the sacrificial table is about 9,000 pounds. But the biggest roof slab we have there on the main site still is about 14 tons, so about 28,000 pounds. So that's a pretty hefty piece of rock, but they separated from the bedrock. And Dr. David Stewart Smith, who passed away 4 years ago, just as we were starting to discover not only these serpentine walls, but beautiful lintled windows in these stone walls. And that's a whole different thing. These things are amazing. But David passed away in 2016 from cancer. He had been with us since 1978, and he had a doctorate in historical anthropology, theology, and he was an trained archaeologist. Spent a lot of time in Europe, too, 6 years working for the British government back in the 70s. He was from Connecticut, came back home in 78, joined my dad's group called the New England Antiquities Research Association, which is still going strong. And he was amazed that these structures existed because he had left Connecticut not knowing these things are here, worked for the British government on megalithic sites. It was part of what we call the English Heritage today, but it was before, I think in 83, English Heritage was formed. It was the group before that, and he helped restore some medieval stuff and megalithic stuff. And when he came back to New England, I was like, oh my God, we got these stonework here. He goes, there are some differences between this megalith and some of the stuff over there. But he goes, the stonework here is amazing, you know. And he worked on the way the stones were quarried without metal tools, the way they were shaped or dressed with using hammer stones. And the first stone in situ, which is one of these big slabs, was found in 1982 by one of our staff members. And Dave had informed our staff to look for big slabs of stone out in the woods, maybe propped up with like a field stone, a rounded stone or whatever. Hmm. And maybe the edge of it looks serrated, like the edge of an arrowhead, and a little dimpled. And so this woman named Mary, one of our guides, she was up there sitting having a picnic lunch by herself out in the middle of what was the woods at the time. And she noticed sitting on this rock, it seemed to be elevated and the edge of it seemed to be serrated. And so she looked at it a little closer, got underneath it and said, huh, it looks like it's propped up. She brought it to the attention of David when he came. You know, he was down there, you know, every now and then. Wow. He came down because he was a professor too. So he came down and he saw that and he goes, oh my God, I think we got a quarried stone, and it was in the process of being separated, raised up or propped, and it was being shaped or dressed with hammer stones. And Dr. Gary Hume, the state archaeologist, the same name as our archaeologist, they're both friends, but they're not related. and they live near each other too. And he's still alive. But 1983, he was a state archaeologist and he was mainstream. They twisted his ear to come down and look at this. So he got quite interested and he actually oversaw Dr. David Stewart Smith and his assistants. And he said, it's unmistakable that these people were quarrying stones, yeah, shaping stones, using stone tools, and it's being shaped like a ton and a half or 2-ton arrowhead or whatever. So it's Stone Age technology used to shape or dress these stones, not metal tools. So that kind of puts it before the colonial period, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Which you'd be using metal tools, you know. So
yeah, and it goes, it almost puts it like before the Copper Age.
It does. And one thing we thought about, too, because if the site was anything to do with the megalithic sites of Europe, copper was still pretty, or bronze, you know, it was made out of copper and timber. It was very, very valuable. So there would have been people still using stone tools, around the world today. There are people using stone tools. We've gone past the space age. I mean, and there are some primitive tribes today. So some of these people probably had some metal tools, perhaps bronze, but it would have been expensive and rare, you know, to have them covered soon.
And the funny thing is, you know, I mean, a lot of people will be like, you know, the hardness of granite, especially gray granite. But whenever you start getting into things like dolomite and stuff like that, whenever you start getting into things like pegmatite, some of the stones like what are up in Maine, that tourmaline grow in, that kind of stuff, you're looking at right up around the same hardness as granite, you know,
pretty hard. Yeah.
Would definitely be something that, especially this, like, as opposed to redstone granite, like what we have here in Texas, which is high in carbon and high in feldspar, the gray granite is a lot softer than that. So to be able to shape that with something like pegmatite, I mean, if you can't tell, I'm a rocks and minerals nerd.
No interest at all.
Because I loved rock hounding in Maine. It was so amazing. Great formations all up there in New Hampshire as well. And that's just it. To see this kind and this quality of of granite. This is not like surface found granite.
Hmm.
This has definitely been
come up in layers.
Yeah, it's definitely been quarried granite. It's definitely been worked.
Yeah. Definitely.
See the precision of the workmanship on things like the stone table, the so-called sacrificial table. Not that there's ox blood found or anything like that, folks. It just oddly looks like there is a. It looks like if you've ever worked at a butcher shop or seen a butcher shop, it looks like a dressing table where there's a blood groove that is supposed to go into a sink or a drain. And it, like, you can see it right there distinctly in the top upper third of the right-hand side. It's just, it's really remarkable. But even if you look at that rounded corner, like, it's so fine. The detail of it is so fantastic. And to know that that may have been done with stone tools is just phenomenal. It's really, really amazing.
It's kind of a bell shape. You know, we have located its quarry socket. It's actually under the astronomical center of the site.
And
so we know where the stuff, and it came about 40 feet. They moved it, you know, and it, they probably moved it across the bedrock and set it up on its four legs right next to the oracle chamber.
Even to have
and
quarried that, it with stone, though.
Tube, yeah.
My God.
It is, you know, what we discovered about it recently, just in the last couple of years, is that groove we always thought was rectangular, you know, 90 degree corners. It is not. It's a trapezoid.
Now,
that's another discovery in the last word. Not only is the table have that is that groove trapezoid, but it doesn't conform to imperial measurements of inches, feet, and yards or anything like that. Neither does the site. And Roscoe Whitney, MIT engineer, was working on the site with Mr. Goodwin as a foreman back in the 1930s, 37, you know, 38, 39. And he actually mapped the site. He used a plane table, so he did cross-sections, profile, and plan view. We have all of those records, all the maps he made of the site. He said at the time, he goes, whoever built the site either didn't give a damn or know anything about linear measurements, because I've measured the width, the height, the depth of these chambers. I've looked at imperial measurements, and it does not conform to them. He did not know about the megalithic yard. And the megalithic yard was discovered by Dr. Alexander Thom in Scotland. We met him back in 1983 when we had supper with him and his son, Dr. Archibald Thom. They both deceased now. They're very famous, working on the megalithic sites of Europe. Actually surveying them, you know, and finding that they're not only aligned with the heavens, but they actually use the standard unit of measure, what he called the megalithic yard. And there was a megalithic rod, an inch, and a megalithic fathom. But my dad and I met them back then, and we had a wonderful supper. They gave us turkey, and it turns out it was our Thanksgiving over here. They didn't know that. So it was a really nice evening with them. And but anyway, back in the 70s, when I was already aware of the megalithic yard from Dr. Thom's work. You know, we've been reading it, we're corresponding with him. And I looked at, when I made my diorama that you can visit when you come into the visitor center, it's right there when you walk in. It's about a 30 acre of the 110 acres with the astronomical alignments and everything. And I was doing some measuring with a couple of other workers there at the time back in the 70s. And I said, you know, this megalithic 32.64 inches seems to fit some of these structures, but we didn't really pursue that. It was like, this is really interesting, you know. But more recently, just since 2016, we've been measuring things like the groove on the table. And the bottom of the groove is 1.5 megalithic yards. The top is 1.25. The length of that groove is two megalithic yards. The height of the table above the bedrock is one megalithic yard. And the width of the table is 2.5 megalithic yards, and it's bell-shaped. So up near the top, it's 2 megalithic yards. The length of it we couldn't get because it goes into the oracle chamber. You know, the part of it actually goes into the walls, and we'd have to tear it apart to get actual measurements. But we started measuring some of the chambers. Not only does the megalithic yard seem to work, and it's preliminary, but we found that the structures are actually trapezoid in shape, too. The courtyard, some of the chambers, and a thing we call the Paddy's cellar is actually trapezoid. We've been using handheld LIDAR this year. It's a $50,000 unit, and a gentleman from Connecticut's come up, and he's mapped 15 acres of the 110. He's put 600 hours of processing into it, and you can measure down to 1 centimeter, because this is really high-resolution LIDAR. And we can use it to not only maybe determine what standard unit of measure, like the megalithic yard or something else, But when you look at the LIDAR, it strips out all the vegetation and everything. You can look at the chambers very, very, you know, very, get a perfect view of these things. When you look at them, it's like, oh my God, you can see the trapezoid shape in the courtyard, the plaza, you know, some of the chambers. But he actually went into the chambers and mapped them too. So we got a lot of things going on there with the serpent wall, the windows, perhaps the megalithic yard. But the trapezoid shape is something we just discovered too. And I was reading about some of the structures in England, which I visited some of them in England, but I couldn't get to all of them. But one thing caught my eye on a book, I forget the name of it, was they do have trapezoid shapes to the plan view, I guess, of some of the structures, you know, some of the floor plans, I should say. Yeah.
I was going to say, specifically, as an audio engineer, one of the things that you have to do in order to make a, quote, anechoic chamber is to get rid of right angles.
Oh, wow.
Which basically means that you float a room inside of a room and each wall is about 1 degree off from center so that you are not creating a cube, and that gives nowhere for a resonant bass wave to occur. So perhaps especially because that is a stone room, and I don't know, I'm just going there once again. I'm throwing out another thing for you, especially with those being observational spaces. If you're supposed to be in there for a long time, if you were to start hearing vibrations, echoes, things like that, that could definitely disturb your vision. If you were trying to observe stars, once again, from a very enclosed space, which those spaces are maybe 5.5 feet tall, like they are not big enough for a person of my height to just walk freely inside of. And they're maybe about the same width, you know, at least from the looks of them from the outside. So to think about that, as far as it being a hard resonant surface and carrying a resonant wave, it would be interesting to see, you know, if you clapped your hands, if it echoed inside of there at all.
Well, that's interesting you bring this up, because my son, he played a couple different musical instruments, and one of his music teachers, he had a couple different ones. Mm. We homeschooled my son too, but then he went to college and he's an engineer like my dad was, but he, his music teacher was saying that like the Oracle chamber is perfectly tuned. You know, I wasn't there that day. I wish I could have talked to him more about that, but he told my wife that. But Scott Walters from American Earth brought it up 7 years ago when he shot this, I guess it would be almost 8 years ago in 2012, he came up and filmed the episode on us, and he was talking about acoustical archaeology.
Yeah.
And I know in Malta, we've been to Malta, and you know, the hypogeum is supposed to be like that. And even at Stonehenge, I guess there's some sort of acoustical properties to it and other sites too.
Yeah. If you go to Chichen Itza.
I've been there. Yeah.
Chichen Itza, if you clap, it makes the sound of the Thunderbird. If you stand in the right spot, between the stairway and the back wall and clap, you hear it pop, 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 like echo between it. And that's supposed to represent the flap of the Thunderbird.
And then that's one of the things they talked about, the Thunderbird. Yeah, that's amazing. We visited that. I know I'll have to check and go back there. I mentioned the Oracle Chamber and the Equinox, and that's one place where the serpent comes down on the Equinox, the shadow on the 91 steps, you know? And so there's this Equinox and... there's an Equinox and a serpent tie-in. There's a thing called the Pathfinder Cave in Colorado, and it's a natural cave, but inside of it's all this petroglyphs. And one of the glyphs is a serpent, and it's an Equinox. And the Equinox, spring or fall, the sunrise actually illuminates some artwork, including the serpent. And another one's called the Crack Creek Cave. That's also in Colorado, and it does the same thing there. And then, of course, our site has that. Illumination on the equinox. This might be a tie-in. And it seems like different cultures, or I don't know if there's any connection, but do the same kind of thing. But Chichen Itza on the equinox has a serpent going down the steps, the shadow effect, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the same day we got our thing going on too in the morning, you know?
Well, and it really, that is very interesting to know that you have cast shadows like that are organized along the space, because it's just something that stands out as not being typical Native American. Not that the stars were not important, but they were not quite known like the Mayas, the Aztecs, things like that for building things that were used for observation in that way. I know that the Anasazi and the West Coast did some of that, and over in Arizona, that kind of stuff. But most of the East Coast tribes were, and that's what I'm referring to when I say Native Americans, most of the tribes indigenous to that area, that is not what their practice was.
That's right. Yeah. And they don't seem to have a historical or, tradition of this, you know, orally, you know, but we're still, you know, we still have an open mind about that because we know they're here. Were they involved with it or were they not involved with it or involved with it a little bit, you know? And so who were the builders of this site and some of the others across the whole Northeast? I will say the serpent thing, because the Great Serpent Mountain in Ohio, and that friend from Texas, she's been up there twice last year to go to the spring and equinox and the summer solstice celebration. She went all the way up twice. And I used to fly into Columbus, and that's, you know, it's a little ways from there in Cleveland. And I used to do a lot with American in there, and I never had the opportunity because we get in there, we go to the hotel, get food, go to sleep, wake up, you know, do another day. And I went in there so many times, and I did visit a few things in Ohio, I took advantage, but I didn't get to the Great Serpent Mountain. That thing is 1,350 feet long, and it is aligned with the solstices and equinoxes, and it's built on the rim of a meteorite crater, which is something I think they only discovered in the last, you know, dozen years or so. I was never aware of that, and I used to read about that, and I never knew until recently. But it does have the some of the solar alignments, you know, the four seasons, you know.
Well, there is no way. I've got the image up on screen for our audience. Again, there is no way that what is carved out of those trees is accidental. No way.
Right. Yeah.
You drew flight plans. You drew observational maps. You drew that like that is an observational map. That is definitely like a, if you look in this cardinal direction, you will see this. And even though that is, like you said, what y'all have cleared to expose what is there, once again, that's there. That stuff is there. Yeah. And this is not the typical construction of the local Indians. This is not the typical construction of the local indigenous people.
Right. Exactly. I will say that the, you know, the as above, so below, we're looking at the walls a little closer. I mean, we have probably 13 serpentine walls, and we have GPS'd them and mapped them. And we found another one I haven't mapped. I think I have number 14 now. But they range from about 30 feet up to about 2,550 feet. There is a site, the site's all over the Northeast. And 4 years ago in the fall, I went to a meeting, the New England Antiquities Research Association. My dad, again, started that in 64. They have spring and fall meetings because this year with C-19, it's all messed up. But in Groton, Connecticut, there's a site called Gungeewomp, and it's been known about since John Pynchon wrote to Governor Winthrop in 1654 and asked basically what the heck this place is. So it was all built by colonial settlers. When you think they know what it was in 1654, but they didn't, you know, they didn't know what it was. Well, next door is a town called North Stonington, Connecticut. And a book came out and was on the, you know, they have like, during the meetings, they always have like a table with books, you know, for sale. And I went over and looked at this, and it was Ceremonial Stonework by Markham Starr. 2016, the book just came out, and it talks on the back cover about 8,000 different stone features, 240 photographs, and it's a beautiful book. And I'm looking at it going, this must be all of New England, 8,000 different features? That's going to be scattered all over the Northeast or New England. It actually was a town in North Stonington, over 35,000 acres, I believe, if I read it. I just read it a little while ago to get some of the things. Anyway, they have chambers that look like our chambers. They have standing stones. They have cairns, which are big piles of rocks. They have all these different types of walls. And as you look closer, they have some of the windows like we have built right into the stone walls, beautiful lintelled windows. And one thing that caught my eye right away, because I didn't know these existed anywhere else, was a stone wall that looks like a serpent. And by the fall of 2016, I believe I knew of about three or four of these serpentine walls. And I had found the first one in the spring of 2016. And I'm looking, and there's over 400 of these stone walls in North Stonington, Connecticut. And again, they range from about 30 feet up to 300 feet, with the average being 100 feet. And they look like our serpentine walls. And again, they can be linear, they can be rectilinear, or they can be kind of curvilinear. Wow. They look like big, you know, sweeping serpents. And they can have a head that's a glacial boulder that looks like a serpent's head, or they can have a stacked head. And some of these serpentine walls have windows. And in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, my friend from Bullitt, Texas, I mentioned, she went there. And I haven't been to this so close to us, too, the Berkshires. They yeah. have the serpentine walls there, too. And one of the gentlemen who's been on, had his own TV show on history, showed her some of these. And in these serpentine walls are some of these beautiful lintled windows, like at our site.
Wow.
So our site is not by itself. It is kind of the Reader's Digest version of all the sites. Everybody goes,
sure.
Everything that you have, your site is located everywhere well, else.
Now,
you
know? now granted, maybe the walls, but when you come to some of the strange features, when you come to, once again, some of the dating and truly, for me, once again, it's the archaeoastronomy. It is those alignments, those things that were built with utter precision in mind, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, just to, not to beat a dead horse, but man, just to look at that image overhead of what y'all have cleared to expose what is there. And it looks like an observational map.
It really does. And, you know, Chris, we're doing the thing with LIDAR. The gentleman from Connecticut, he has the LIDAR. He's out of Suffield, Connecticut, Tom Elmore. And Net Geo Group is his company. And he has one of the only handheld LIDARs. You know, he got one of the first ones. You know, he got it like a year and a half ago. And it does something like 150,000 points per square meter. So, again, the resolution's incredible. You can use it for standard unit of measure, I guess, down to at least a centimeter. But
wow.
When you look at his LIDAR images of the astronomical alignments of the main site and, of course, the serpentine walls, when you look at that imaging, it's like fantastic. And we're putting a PowerPoint presentation together, and we're going to identify all like the solar alignments, the lunar alignments, the stellar alignments. And then we're going to, and it'll be on part of the PowerPoint. And then we're going to have like the serpentine walls and then the regular walls,
oh,
you know?
Man.
So that will be all highlighted, and it'll be pretty cool. And the other thing that happened last year on 9/11, you know, and that was that day was
yeah.
so special. I mean, it was because of what happened. But my first granddaughter was born on that day, emergency C-section, and we're so delighted. Her name is Juliet. So
congrats.
She was born on 9/11, 5 weeks early. And while that was going on with her going to the emergency room, we had a group of about 25 people doing what is called the optically stimulated luminescence testing at our site, OSL. And what they do is they take cores of dirt next to a structure on the roof or next to the walls and even some of the stones, and they take them to a laboratory and do all these different chemical, you know, treatments to it or whatever, and then they shoot lasers at it. And what they can tell you is the last time that that dirt basically saw the light of day.
Oh, wow.
And they did four cores at our site. We had two New Hampshire state archaeologists from Concord, New Hampshire, our capital down.
Yep.
They had never been to our site before. We had Dr. Feathers from the University of Washington. He had to go through all the C-19 testing like everybody, I guess, did. But he flew out, and he was in New England for about 10 days, but he was at our site on 9/11 all day. His two assistants came from Brookhaven National Laboratory on Long Island. They were up, and they're originally from France, you know?
Oh, wow.
And then we had a licensed geologist who has also got a master's in geophysics, too. And we had the research team from New England Antiquities Research Association, and they were kind of working with Dr. Feathers on this whole thing directly. And then we had the gentleman with LIDAR, Tom Elmore, bought his LIDAR. He had already mapped where they were doing the cores, but he wanted to be on site when they did it. And then his friend from Massachusetts has a company called Radar Solutions International. She has the GPR, the ground penetration radar, and she had been up before in the spring, and she came for this special occasion, and she actually ran the radar over where they're taking the cores in the Oracle Chamber. So I wanted that mapped, you know, the surface and the subsurface. So if there's any questions about where these cores came from, it's on her data. Now she's going to take her gator, and they're going to put it together with a LIDAR, and it's going to be the first time we have 3D above and below ground imaging where she ran her rave. He did 15 acres. She only did like a few thousand square feet because it's very time consuming running her equipment back. And I helped her. I was like, oh my, she's been up about three or four times. So that's going to be interesting. The results, I was told, preliminary results will come out in April. And they did four cores. One of them was in front of the watch house at the end of its tail, the serpent's tail. It does another up and down like a hump. They took a core from the front of that. They did three from the oracle chamber. And that's the biggest structure still on the site, right next to the sacrificial table. They did four other places in New England. And so we're going to be excited to see what the results of those places are. They may be, you know, contemporary with our site. We just don't know.
Yeah.
2 years ago in Pennsylvania, a site called Oley Hill, it was a big stone man-made platform.
Yep.
Kind of like a big square con. And it had some terracing. And, you know, the mainstream kind of, all of these things are built by farmers 200, 300 years ago. They're all colonial, post-colonial. Well, the results came back this last summer. It took almost 2 years to get the results back.
There were no colonial farmers practicing terraced farming.
Yeah, and this thing is like a big, actually more like a big platform. I mean,
that's more of a South American form of farming.
Yeah.
The terraced farming. Yeah. Like that's like what the Mayans and Olmecs and people like that, people who live in mountainous terrain. Practice.
And they had to. It made sense. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, the results on this came back, and the dates range somewhere. The more recent date, I think, was something I'm going to top of my head. They had like several dates. But I say about 370 AD. The oldest date was 3000 BC, and they say the central date or the medium, it was weighted, you know, the medium date was about 570 BC. So it could be older than that. So this is not. This is before Christ, you know. This is not something that was colonial, post-colonial. So we're excited, and Dr. Feathers was involved with that. That was a separate project altogether in 2018.
Even to echo back to earlier in the episode, your location was talked about in 1600 documents.
Yeah, it goes quite a ways back. I mean, it goes back into. I mentioned my Uncle Oz, my dad's first cousin, who was a pilot, and he worked in the astronomy. He told me in 2015, before he moved to Long Island to his oldest daughter's home, my uncle's wife had Alzheimer's, and they wanted to gather the family together, so he moved away. He came to the museum, and he gave me some of his books, and we talked and everything. It's the last time I saw him, but he goes, you know, my grandmother, Annie Gage, used to play up at this place back in the 1890s, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah, we have documentation going back to 1734 with the Patty family, you know, when they bought a piece of the property. In 1741, they bought 1744, they bought another piece of the property. They were shoemakers, actually. They made shoes. They were cordwainers, you know, and they bought some of the land. It doesn't look like a shoe shop, the site. It doesn't look like a farm. Some people say the sacrificial table was a big cider press. It doesn't look like a cider mill at all. And you can't get anything by the table as far as like a horse and a buggy to carry the apples or anything like that. Plus the nearest apple orchard was like a half a mile down the hill. It wouldn't be impossible, but it'd be kind of crazy to bring all those apples up there. And you'd have to unload them by hand because you couldn't get within about 30 or 40 feet of the table because there's a big ramp there. There's a big standing monolith there. There's a niche, like a stone niche that's trapezoid in shape. And on the other side of the table is a big standing stone and the oracle chambers to the east. I have a three-wheel ATV. I have three ATVs. The smallest one's a three-wheeler. I can't get that in there with a cart to get the leaves out. They have to carry them by hand because, you know, if you're going to design that for a cider mill, you'd be able to get your horse and wagon right by there and all the apples and then all the stuff.
Precisely. You've got to have somewhere to load and unload stuff.
Yeah, you can't do it. You can't do it there, you know. So
nobody in their right mind's going to, like, just carry barrels of cider down the road.
You can't do it there. It's because of the stonework. It's all in the way, and you got two big monoliths there, and then you have a big roof slab that shouldn't be there. But even without the roof slab there, you couldn't get in there, you know, with a horse. You can't get a horse in, you can't get anything in there, you know. You can walk in there and grab the leaves, pull them out.
And
so
once again, though, it just goes back to, and there are some, I'm trying to remember all the Indian tribes from the area, the Ossipee, Winnipesaukee, there's quite a few, but none of them were necessarily known as archaeoastronomers.
Right.
None of them were necessarily known as megalithic site builders. They, you know, they had some cultivation means.
Yeah.
To be able to grow some basic crops. But most of the time they lived somewhere for a little while, then they moved on.
You know,
and,
exactly.
and even even the same with the First Nations tribes up in like the Acadia and stuff like that up in Nova Scotia. But I find it once again very, very interesting, this similarity between the wall that you have and the wall on Oak Island.
Oh, yeah, thanks for telling me that, too. That's the second time I've heard that.
To know, once again, that this was not the kind of structure that was built by these people. They were not necessarily structure builders to begin with, unless it was like, let me build a structure for a few months, and then when the season changes, we will move on to different environs. You know?
Definitely. Yeah, they weren't nomadic here. Whoever built this must have been here, and they must have used it.
They were there for a little while.
At
the very least, even just to look at the expanse, once again, of the site that y'all have uncovered, to say that they were there for a season is a minimal.
Well, we had a gentleman from Penn State, Dr. Winkler. He was a professor of archaeoastronomy. He joined us around 1997, and around 1999, 2000, he retired after 34 years. He was there from 64 up to, I would say, about 1999 or 2000, you know, 35 years, I guess. He was teaching at Penn State, and while he was still teaching, he would be driving up here when he could, you know, to visit my dad, visit us, and also do some work on the astronomy, kind of picking up the work that my uncle and other people did in the 70s and trying to identify some of those star alignments, because the Harvard-Smithsonian Report 1978 said, well, if these alignments were used for the purpose of, or these stone markers are used for the purpose of astronomical alignments, it would work about 1800 BC plus or minus 200 years due to the Earth's tilt. You know, the obligate changes very slowly. And that data that we fed them in 1977, and we get the results in 78, was from a 1973 through 1977 survey by Beverly Pearson and Associates. The father was a surveyor and president of New England Surveyors Association, so he hired somebody, you know, with good credentials. And his son, Charlie, is still alive. And Charlie just retiring from survey work.
Oh, wow.
And he just sent me a message about a week ago, which, thank you for reminding me, because I got to respond to him. He just sent me some new data.
But
he's
cool.
But he's interested. But he's pretty interested, because I mentioned to him about 2 years ago when he came up with his wife. He didn't have time to go up on the property. I saw him in the parking lot. And then his wife was chewing his ear off to get going. But I started telling him about the serpentine walls. I said, we have walls that are shaped like serpents, Charlie. Because when he came up there and surveyed in the 70s, and he did more work in the 80s, you know, they go up and survey the walls and the astronomical alignments. They didn't look at every detail. And a lot of it was covered with brush and trees. And that's why the big S-shaped serpent, one of the big ones, is that's 150 feet from point to point. We walked by that for decades, and it was just enough brush in front of it, around it, and not really having our eyes open. That's the other problem. You're not looking for it. We walked by that wall for decades, and we never realized we were looking at an S-shaped serpent wall with a triangular stone head, you know, and there's other features in that, too, that repeat. There's
triangular stone head that points to the sun.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we never noticed that. And my dad died 11 years ago, and he didn't know about one serpent wall, but he used to go out with Dr. Winkler, and they would, towards the end of my dad, Winkler's life, he died about 2001, I think it was, suddenly from a heart attack. So he retires, has a little retirement, and dies suddenly. It was really sad. He was just really getting into the site. But before he did die, my dad and he would go out on my dad's ATV, and they would go around, and they were looking at the walls, measuring them. And my dad would tell me, I'd be out flying, he'd tell me, you know, after his, at the hotel or whatever, you know, these walls are amazing, and there's thousands. And he measured how many miles, actually, of walls we have here on top of the hill, how much work went into them. But he goes, yeah, big slabs of stone. Farmers are building stone walls that are fairly straight, you know, pretty linear, but they have field stones, rounded type rocks. He goes, this wall, these walls out here have so many pieces of quarried slab that either stood up, you know, we call them orthostats if they stood on their end. And if they stood up vertically, we call them monoliths. And then there's like some of them, you know, have other different features in these walls.
They're huge.
Yeah, pretty big, you know. And
they're like 7 feet tall, some of them.
Some of them are, yeah. Actually, one of the Mayday Sunrise Stone has fallen, and that measures about 10 feet tall, and the Equinox Sunrise is about the same, about 10 foot tall. They're both falling over, probably because they're so big, you know, the weight, they got earthquakes and stuff knocked them over.
Oh, my God. And that's just it. Once again, whenever you look at the area, because, I mean, I lived in the area. I've got a 207 area code to this day.
I mean, yeah, there's a TV show in the Portland station.
Here in Texas,
yep.
Here in Texas, you would be what we call spitting distance away.
Yeah. I think my friend from Bullet told me that one.
It tripped my mind out the first time I traveled from Maine to Massachusetts, and I crossed two state lines in less than an hour. I was like, wow, what's that about? Like, I don't even cross Houston in an hour.
I know your counties or whatever in Texas are huge, you know? I mean, they're just, that always amazes me down there how big things are.
But to see the expanse of this property, to see the expanse of the building, to once again, just look at that overhead of what y'all have cleared and just the intent, just the intention of what has been cleared. So that you can see what you can see and work, that is a place built with intention. It's not a place built accidentally. Yeah. It's not a place built in passing. Nobody builds something that straight lined for no good reason.
You know, that's funny. You know, you said that the Tom Elmore with the LIDAR, he's got a master's degree in landscape architecture, and he basically said what you just said about
you could go and that's just it. Like, you could say, hey, somebody was trying to mark their property line. Cool, look at all the property lines around that in this picture, folks. How straight are they? Most of those, quite a few of those, I guarantee you, have a stone wall either next to them. There are very few property lines in that area that do not exist back to the days of the 1600s, 1700s, where you don't see some kind of remnant of a stone wall somewhere, you know? And it's pretty rare that you see it on a straight axis.
You know, it's funny, our surveyor, Charlie, you know, he said basically he went in and he looked at the town, you know, on microfiche and everything in town records, and he looked at the property lines, and he goes, almost all of your walls up here do not match any property lines. There's just a couple of them that do, probably because somebody saw a wall and took advantage of it. I would too, even if it was an ancient wall. But these walls twist, bend, and they turn. And a lot of them we found out just in the last couple of years by looking and clearing. We're doing so much clearing up there with hedge trimmers, and we're actually got a forestry thing. They seem to, my wife calls it like the rosary bead wall, because the wall seems to go from boulder to a boulder, and then it will zigzag over to another boulder. Now, a farmer would build a wall pretty, or a professional wall builder for a farmer would build a wall straight right through the boulder, but continue. These walls will go out of their way connecting boulders, and that's in Connecticut too, and that's in other sites. The Hudson Valley of New York, by the way, Westchester and Putnam County have over, and if you include out to Woodstock with the 69, you know, Woodstock and Bethel, New York, actually it was, that area has over 500 different structures. So that area is the highest density, is just north of New York City. But the same thing applies there. These walls will go from a boulder to another boulder. Then you have serpentine walls there, and you have some windows there. But these kind of things exist in Mount Shasta out in Weed again. And that's one of the things I noticed too. Not only do the walls have, like, some are chevron shape. We have a chevron shape here. Some have the serpentine walls, and some of the walls in that area of Weed, California, near Mount Shasta, go from a boulder. It will go to a boulder, and then it will zigzag to another boulder. I'm like, it could be coincidental, but farmers make a wall and a boundary and a field clearing and a stock fence pretty straight, with some exceptions, you know. And these walls do everything but that. They're all over the damn place, you know, turning, twisting, and bending, you know. So that's what we have here. They're crazy walls, and then they have windows in them. These windows are actually lintled windows, and some of them have stone shutters, and these are in the stone walls. I mean, we have windows in the chambers, in a couple of the chambers, but these are in the walls, and I found 14 of them. And one serpent wall has four of them in a wall in a row, and I don't know if you have any pictures of those lintled windows, but they're actually
beautiful. I don't have any pictures of the lintled windows. I don't think there were any for me to steal from your website.
Oh, Don, I wish I had sent you a couple. I would have given you a couple. You didn't make a steal. I would say, yeah.
If you got pictures you want me to use, yeah, you got to make them publicly available so I can steal them, see?
Yeah. I'm sorry about that.
No. I'm just playing with you.
No, I know. I wish I had them for you because sometimes you're near the bottom of the wall. Sometimes you're midway in height up the wall. And sometimes they are like, they're a couple of them next to each other. And like I mentioned in the Berkshires, they have some serpent walls, they have windows, and a couple of them were a window next to a window. There's no reason a farmer would build these windows.
No.
And again, some have shutters that are vertical.
Once again, these structures to begin with are nowhere near big enough for you to like hang out in any kind of permanent fashion.
No,
they are not made.
No,
they are not constructed for you to live in. They're definitely not constructed because, hey, you know, early people were simple folk, but you know what they weren't? They weren't stupid. They knew that when you had fire, you needed a way for it to escape. You needed a way for smoke to escape, or you were going to, like, choke, you know? That's why teepees had an open top.
And you know, the Oracle Chamber is amazing because, and we're just talking stone walls, not even chambers, you know, these are just stone walls with windows, but the chambers have windows. The Oracle Chamber has, like, 5 stone closets in it. It runs true north and south. The east-west portion of it is actually core built, you know, the inverted staircase building style. It looks like almost like an arch, you know, and that has got the core building. We did find that the chamber in ruins in the last 4 years actually has 3 walls. The 3 corners are core built. That's an old world technique of bridging a ceiling, basically, like inverted staircase kind of shape, you know. And another chamber there has a core building too. And that's another discovery just in the last 4 years. We knew the Oracle Chamber had it since forever, you know, had the core building.
Yeah.
But on the north end of that chamber, the Oracle Chamber, and by the way, the megalithic units seem to fit that. There's a chimney flue. And the chimney, until 1958, the year my dad opened it up to the public as Mystery Hill Caves, had 2 stone louvers in there. And these louvers could be used to adjust the draft of perhaps a fire. But the other thing we look at that, and they were stolen that year. I think some of our visitors took them away, and we have pictures of them, and we have all the records of them, but they're gone today. So they've been missing for 60-something years, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
And it had a stone that would actually slide across the top of that and block the entire chimney.
Wow.
But a gentleman from Harvard University was working with me about 20 years ago, and he was a professor at Harvard, and he would come up. He was really interested in the astronomy, just like you and I are and the rest of us. But he was thinking about zenith alignments, like some in Mexico, you know, in South America, they'll look directly up at stars, you know.
Sure.
And we actually started working on that project using that chimney. And he was going back in time because Earth's tilt has changed, you know, and then you had the precession of the equinoxes. He was actually working on that coming up with a couple of stars that would actually pass through that chimney if you sat in the bottom and looked straight up. And we did that at night. We'd go up there at night and watch because we saw what was happening today, not what was happening 4,000 years ago. But that was another possibility because you mentioned stars and looking at something from a chamber.
Yeah.
And that's something we looked at. And that was back 1999, 2000, 2001, somewhere around there. We're working with that.
Well, and, you know, something that just crossed into my mind, just looking again at this overhead view, man. It's kind of creepy. you need 6 points of reference to map something in 3D space. And it certainly looks like you have almost 6 radii coming off of this circle on the property, like 6 pie-shaped radii to mark a spot in 3D space.
Where
the last one would be overhead. Just throwing it out there. Weird, strange things.
Yeah. I mean, we're still, that's perfect because that gets you thinking, you know. And then when you start thinking of these different things, sometimes it takes somebody on the outside to see things that we can't see because,
if you look at it, and quite literally, this is at minute 9, second 18 in your video. Is the overhead view that I'm referencing. Yeah. And it quite literally looks like the coordinates of something within 3D space.
Interesting.
Really wild. But once again, even to look at it as something that is used for astronomical observation.
Exactly.
Practiced by really the Indians of Nova Scotia necessarily, which would mm-hmm. be the closest neighbors to anything like the Penobscots or Penacook or Winnipesaukee or Ossipee, any of those that would be in that area.
The Pawtucket and the Pentucket, the Penacook, exactly. Yeah, you know the tribe. We've talked to some Native Americans too, ones that belong to the Wampanoag and even ones that are a little bit closer. One of them said he has actually Orkney Island blood in him, might be part of the Sir Henry St. Clair coming over in 1398. But anyway, he said it wasn't in his family's tradition to build these kind of stone structures, whether that's correct or incorrect. He didn't feel it was of the Native American, part of him, that was involved with these stone structures. I would say something too, my dad did find, and not only my dad, but some of the other researchers independently kind of, that if you draw a point from like a corner of a wall or one of the monoliths into another, so you have to have three different points, maybe two monoliths in a corner of a wall or something like that, that is very, it has to be something very obvious, not too subtle. It has to be something there. Well, they found equilateral triangles and isosceles triangles on and they actually have maps across the whole hilltop. And again, it could be coincidental, but when you have these repeating triangles over and over and over again, and it was done by different people. And I have the maps in my files.
That's exactly what you have in your overhead view, man.
Oh, you see it.
Not even joking. That's exactly you have.
Wow.
It's just, it looks like pie wedges that intersect over the site.
I think that's what triggered my triangle thing. Yeah, I think that's what probably got me.
I don't even know if it's related to the theory that you're talking about, but there it is once again. I've got it up on screen. Yeah. Minute 9, second 18 in your video. And this is the overhead view that I've been referencing the whole time, which is the view of what y'all have cleared out to expose what is there.
Yeah. So that maybe a geometry to the site too,
Absolutely.
Dr. Tom worked on that. Yeah. He found out like some of the stone circles in Scotland, there are like 700 of them. And not only they were called recumbent stone circles, and on the south side, there'd be a big flat stone, almost like an altar, but they were increased in height. So they actually were graduated in height. As you look from, if you stood on the north side of, there's about 800 circles in Scotland, ancient megalithic circles. But on the north side, and you're looking south, and it's so far north in latitude, everything is further south. So when you have a lunar major moonrise south, it's very low on the horizon.
Yeah.
And every 18 and a half years, you have that. The next one will be coming up in 2025, I guess. We're getting ready for that, too.
The lunar interesting. Major.
Yeah, and we're having the foresters actually open up those avenues that have never been open since we began in 1967. They'll be open for the first time.
I want to be there for that.
Well, I'll remind you, because we're excited about it.
Oh, there's no joke, my friend. I will be there, cameras in hand. Like, whatever footage you want to get, we'll get it.
Yeah. This sounds terrific. Yeah, we're excited about it. Yeah.
Like, that's incredible to know that there is an alignment coming up with this property. Yeah. If there's a, like I said, I got friends, I got people up in the area. I definitely got somewhere to stay. So, the chances of me not making it are pretty slim.
Well, you can go,
we'll come up and do a live episode, everything, man. Yeah. I guarantee you,
because
it's just incredible to me to know that there is something like this in the backyard of America. This is not beyond like one or two latitudinal lines for most people in this country, be able to make it to this. Now, I know that you've been more than gracious. We have kept you beyond time, and I want to thank you for that. I want you to know that our airwaves are your airwaves. As you find things out, as they develop, Dennis, let us know, man. We will have you on all day long. I could talk about this all night long. I do not want to keep you because you are on East Coast time. I am on Central. That means that you're an extra hour ahead, and I want to be more than a polite host. Next time, hey, we can plan on much more than an hour, because there is way more than an hour. There's more than like 30 hours of conversation with this place. The conversation is so wide, so has such a breadth and depth to it. It's absolutely phenomenal. And to know that somebody like you has quite literally had a lifetime of experience with this place. You have gotten to see it from the day it was open to the public to now, and to see the route of discovery that has been taken is phenomenal.
Well, thank you so much. I totally enjoyed your show. I hope your listeners enjoyed it. And, you know, we have some exciting things coming up, like the lunar alignment and also the OSL dating. We'll find out what that's going to be, you know, by April. You know, I think it'll be preliminary. But, you know, I'll send you a message about that, too. Maybe we can get on and talk about that.
Oh, yeah. No, most definitely, man. Anything like that that you have coming up, just feel free to reach out to me. My airwaves are yours. We will definitely come on and talk about this again and again and again. Because places like this, I love talking about it. It's absolutely phenomenal that, once again, like I said, these things exist in our backyard in America. This thing was right down the road from me when I lived in Portland, Maine. less than an hour, you know. Just phenomenal. And yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. I want to thank you. Before we let you go, please do tell everybody where they can go to download the free app. Tell them where they can go to find out more information about America's Stonehenge.
Well, I want to thank you again so much for having me on this evening. I had the best time, and I really enjoyed it. And we get some new data and stuff. Maybe the OSL will be talking maybe shortly. But people can go to our website at StonehengeUSA.com. There's a phone number in there. There's an email, so you can, you know, send us questions, or if you want to talk to us that way. We do have Facebook, and we're on Twitter. Instagram, I'm sorry. Yeah. We're on Facebook and Instagram. But on that StonehengeUSA.com, there's also the free app download under America Stonehenge, and you can do a complete virtual tour at home. And you can use it when you come to our site, too. You can walk, and this thing will take you around. And then the 12-minute theater video. I think you might have been using that this evening. I couldn't see it, but that's the one you were using. And that can be watched, too. That's right there on our website.
Yes, you know? It is.
So, yep, you can check it all out. You've got a lot there to look at, you know.
Well,
I'll also throw in there the New England Antiquities Research Association, non-profit organization my dad started in 64, near.org. And you can see other sites, too. And that's a link. I think that's pretty cool, too. So, but thank you so much again.
Oh, yeah, really, man. Once again, anytime. I'm sure that this thank you so much to Mark out there who connected us.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, my friend. I know that he listened into another episode of another guest who he's friends with, and he was like, hey, you did a great job with this. I have somebody else that you may want to be interested in. well, you may want to talk to this guy at America's Stonehenge. And I was like, great, that's awesome. It was one of the most random coinky-dink meetings in the world, but the reason why the universe resonates the way it does and exists is this. So, once again, man, anytime, we would love to have you on. We look forward to having you on regularly with so many regular discoveries going on out there at America's Stonehenge. Please do hold the line while we close things out. Real quick, while you're online checking things out with America Stonehenge, downloading the free app, which, my God, I can't wait to download when I'm off air. I'm so nerdy. Make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can find all the episodes. That is also where you can find the Knowledge Vault full of declassified information, declassified government information right now. I am looking for a huge CIA data dump that just came out, and I cannot wait to get my hands on it to put it there for you guys, because, of course, as of the signing of the new CARES Act, they had 180 days to disclose it all when it came to UAPs and UFOs. So there's going to be all kinds of fun stuff happening on the horizon, folks. Keep your ears open. Keep your heads on a swivel. Until next time, if you can't be good, Be good at it. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.